Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So we are reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, first canto. This is the 10th chapter, verses 11 and 12. So we'll recite responsively verse 11, and then I'll on my own chant verse 12. Satsangan mukta duksango Hatung not sahate buddha Kirtyamanam yaso yasya Sakrid akarnya rochanam Satsangan mukdudu sango Hatung no sahate buddha Kirtimanang yasho yasya Sakrid akarnya rochanam. Please chant. Satsangan mukdaduk sango Atunotsate buddha Kirtimanang yaso yasya Sakrid akanya rochanam Satsangan mukdaduk sango Atuno sahute buddha Kirtimanam yaso yasya Sakrid akarnya rochanam Satsangam ukti duksango Atuno Kirtimanang yaso yasya Sakridakarnya rochanam Satsangan mukta suksango Atung no sahate buddha Kirtimanang yaso yasya Sakridakarnya rochanam Satsangan mukta duh sango Hatung no sahate buddha Kirtimanang yaso yasya Sakridakanya rochanam Vaishnavis Satsangan mukta duh sango Hatuno suhate buddha Kirtimanang yaso yasya Sakridakarnya rochanam Satsangan ukiduk sango Hatuno suhate buddha Kirtimanang yaso yasya Sakridakanya rochanam. And then I'll chant on my own. Tasmin yasta dhiyak parthak sahiran virahang katam darshana sparsha sunglapa shayanasana bhojanai. Word for word, please repeat. Satsangat by the association of pure devotees. Duksangak, freed from bad materialistic association. Hatum, to give up. Na utsahate. Never attempts. Buddhak. One who has understood the Lord. Kirtimanam. Glorifying. Yashak. Fame. Yasya. Unto him. Nyasta dhyak. Are we doing okay? Oh, it's not up there. Yasya's whose, I'm sorry, Yasya who's sakrit, once only. Akarnya, hearing only. Rochanam, pleasing. Tasmin, unto him. Nyasta dhyak, one who has given his mind unto him. Partak, the sons of Pritha. Sahiran, can tolerate. Viraham, separation. Katam, how. Darshana, seeing face to face. Sparsha, touching. Sanglapa, conversing. Shayana, sleeping. Asana, sitting. Bhojanai, dining together. Translation, please repeat. The intelligent, who have understood the Supreme Lord in association with pure devotees, and have become freed from bad materialistic association, can never avoid hearing the glories of the Lord, even though they have heard them only once. How then could the Pandavas tolerate his separation? For they had been intimately associated with his person, seeing him face to face, touching him, conversing with him, and sleeping, sitting, and dining with him. And I'll read it on my own now. Translation, the intelligent who have understood the Supreme Lord in association with pure devotees and have become freed from bad materialistic association can never avoid hearing the glories of the Lord, even though they have heard them only once. How then could the Pandavas tolerate his separation? For they had been intimately associated with his person, seeing him face to face, touching him, conversing with him, and sleeping, sitting, and dining with him. Srila Prabhupada's purports. The living being's constitutional position is one of serving a superior. He is obliged to serve by force the dictates of illusory material energy in different phases of sense gratification. And in serving the senses, he is never tired. Even though he may be tired, the illusory energy perpetually forces him to do so without being satisfied. There is no end to such sense gratificatory business, and the conditioned soul becomes entangled in such servitude without hope of release. The release is only effected by association with pure devotees. By such association, one is gradually promoted to his transcendental consciousness. Thus he can know that his eternal position is to render service unto the Lord and not to the perverted senses in the capacity of lust, anger, desire to lord it over, etc. Material society, friendship, and love are all different phases of lust. Home, country, family, society, wealth, and all sorts of corollaries are all causes of bondage in the material world, where the threefold miseries of life are concomitant factors. By associating with pure devotees and by hearing them submissively, attachment for material enjoyment becomes slackened, and attraction for hearing about the transcendental activities of the Lord becomes prominent. Once they are, they will go on progressively without stoppage, like fire in gunpowder. It is said that Hari, the personality of God, it is so transcendentally attractive that even those who are self-satisfied by self-realization and are factually liberated from all material bondage also become devotees of the Lord. Under the circumstances, it is easily understood what must have been the position of the Pandavas, who were constant companions of the Lord. They could not even think of separation from Sri Krishna, since the attraction was more intense for them because of continuous personal contact. His remembrance by his form, quality, name, fame, pastimes, etc., is also attractive for the pure devotee, so much so that he forgets all forms, quality, name, fame, and activities of the mundane world. And due to his mature association with pure devotees, he is not out of contact with the Lord for a moment. Satsangan uktadukasango hatam notsahate buddha kityamanam yasu yasya sakridakanya rochanam tasman yasta dhyakparta saharan viharaham katham darshana sparsha sanglapa shayanasana bhojanai. I'll read the translation once more. The intelligent who have understood the Supreme Lord in association with pure devotees and have become freed from bad materialistic association can never avoid hearing the glories of the Lord even though they have heard them only once. How then could the Pandavas tolerate his separation, for they had been intimately associated with his person, seeing him face to face, touching him, conversing with him, and sleeping, sitting, and dining with him? Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Praishtaya Bhutale Srimate Bhakti Vedanta Swamini Chinamane Namaste Saraswati Devi Gauravani Prajarine Nirvisesa Shunyavari Pushchacha Deshatarine. Thank you for this opportunity. So in the past several months, I've been thinking a lot about how great exalted personalities, or the Supreme Personality, who, of course, are all transcendental to the material world, manifest their humanness when engaged in human or human-like pastimes. And there appears to be a special quality, a special sweetness to Krishna's earthly pastimes that may even exceed the sweetness of his pastimes in the spiritual world. The drama of either a perfect soul or the supreme soul unfolding their lives, their activities, their family affairs, and so forth on the earthly stage is compelling. One reason is that there's a special element of grace in their earthly pastimes, because Krishna and his pure devotees act not just for the Lord's pleasure, but also to set an example for more multi-generations to come. But their example is not just what to do and what not to do. Krishna demonstrates his personhood in ways that we conditioned souls can understand and relate to. We all have friends we sit with, dine with, talk with, have physical contact with, and when we were kids, maybe we even napped with our friends. So Krishna is showing us by his behavior with the Pandavas that the different kinds of relishable, intimate activities we engage in with close friends and loved ones can also be enacted with him in a pure mood of loving devotion. Of course, Krishna's form is Sat-Chit-Ananda-Vigraha, the very form of eternity, knowledge, and bliss. And this Earth is like a kind of a lower middle class planet in the universe. So why would Krishna agree to take on a form that is apparently made of dense elements like earth and water? In certain sports, a handicap refers to a voluntary disadvantage imposed on a superior contestant, such as a horse race. So why would Krishna apparently handicap himself by accepting an earthly body that passes stool and urine? And that reference is in the 8th chapter of the 10th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, in which Krishna is stealing butter from the contemporaries of Mother Yashoda, and sometimes they accuse him of being a thief. And he says, no, you're a thief. And then in anger, he passes stool and urine in neat, clean places. So it's kind of like an extremely rich man dressing up like a homeless bum and hanging out in the Bowery. Why would Krishna want to slum it, so to speak, on earth? So one answer is that it must somehow increase the sweetness and pleasure of his dealings with his pure devotees. In the book Ananda Vrindavan Champu by the great Kaviraj Karnipur, he states, I didn't know this before, Krishna's babyhood pastimes and pastimes of killing demons exist only in Gokula in the material world. Thus, one should understand that the sweetness of Bhauma Leela, that's Krishna's earthly pastimes, is not available in the spiritual world. And much of Srila Jiva Goswami's Gopal Champu consists of two cowherd boys in the original Vrindavan, Goloka Vrindavan, in the spiritual world, mesmerizing the inhabitants with stories of Krishna's earthly pastimes. It's as if in the original Vrindavan, the inhabitants are relishing the same 10th canto that Srila Prabhupada translated and explained for us and for generations to come. An especially sweet aspect of Krishna's human-like pastimes is that in those leelas he demonstrates the full range of loving mellows or moods, culminating in not just the swakya ras, or conjugal mood in marriage, but the parakya ras, the conjugal mood as a paramour. I once saw a t-shirt on Facebook that read, God has girlfriends, get used to it. I have to remind everyone that the examples I gave about slumming it are for reference only and are not literal, because we must always remember janma karma chame divyam evam yo vijitatvataha. One who knows the transcendental nature of Krishna's birth and activities does not take birth again. So let's set the scene for today's verse. The great war at Kurukshetra is over, and Maharaj Yudhishthira is finally installed without rival as emperor. All the remaining Kurus, which includes the Pandavas, of course, and Lord Krishna and his entourage, go to the river Ganges in great lamentation to offer sacred water to their departed relatives. After they return to Hastinapur, Krishna inspires Yudhishthira to perform 3 Ashwamedha Yajnas, or horse sacrifices. And this spreads Yudhishthira's fame in all directions. It may be that Krishna was trying to encourage Yudhishthira to fully embrace his role as emperor because he felt so burdened by the wholesale slaughter that had taken place in the war. So, first there's great lamentation at the river Ganges, mourning their dead relatives, followed by great sacrificial jubilation. And then Krishna prepares to depart for Dwarka, which happens to be about 800 miles from Hastinapur. So what's the prime dramatic element here? Well, as we just heard in Saturday's Srimad Bhagavatam verse, there's a whole slew of exalted devotees who are on the verge of fainting because they cannot bear separation from Krishna. So as we've read in previous verses, Krishna repeatedly begins to depart. This arouses the fear of separation in his devotees, and then his plans change and he stays. But even though he remains in Hastinapur for some time, the devotees know that this is not his home, so the pain of anticipated separation starts all over again. So, Krishna is about to depart for Dwarka, but to heighten the drama even more amidst this great scene, the lovely Uttara, carrying the last progeny of the Kuru dynasty in her womb, the unborn Parikshit, rushes towards Lord Krishna, pleading for his protection. She even offers to sacrifice her own life to save her unborn son from the quickly approaching Brahmastra weapon launched by the vindictive Ashwatthama. It's really hard to fathom the grand drama of it all, but I'll say that it's infinitely beyond the greatest scenes from the greatest movies that have ever been produced, which, of course, we've never seen. To meet the approaching Brahmastra, the Pandavas take up their respective weapons, and Krishna takes up his Sudarshan Chakra. But in the end, by his personal energy, Krishna covers the embryo and thus saves the unborn Parikshit. So we have the dread of separation from Krishna, followed by a great Vaishnavi in distress, followed by great heroism on the part of the Pandavas and Krishna. For now, disaster is averted and the problem is solved. So again, Krishna is about to depart when Queen Kunti addresses him lovingly with her famous prayers, in which she wishes, quote, that all the calamities we underwent would happen again and again so that we could see you again and again. For seeing you means that we will no longer see repeated births and deaths. So in response to Kunti's poetic glorification, Krishna smiles mildly, which is said to be as enchanting as his mystic power. So yet again, Krishna is about to depart when all of a sudden King Yudhisthira implores him lovingly, lamenting his apparent sins in participating in the Kurukshetra war. Originally, Arjuna was reluctant to fight before the war, concerned about the sins he would incur, and after the war, Yudhisthira sinks deep into lamentation for the sins he thinks he's committed. So once again, Krishna's departure for Dwarka is delayed. In fact, Yudhisthira is so aggrieved about the war that they all decide to visit the battlefield of Kurukshetra, which is about 100 miles away. And then they end up hearing instructions from Grandfather Bhishma on the bed of arrows as he's about to depart this world. And this is another scene that could never be imagined by even the greatest mundane screenwriters, full of lamentation and exultation, wisdom and guidance and tears of deep affection and love. And when Bhishma Dev finally passes away, as the Bhagavatam states, knowing that he had merged into the unlimited eternity of the Supreme Absolute, all present there became silent like birds at the end of the day. Then both men and demigods sounded drums in honor, and showers of flowers fell from the sky. So again, the theme of today's class is the special quality of humanness that pervades Krishna's earthly pastimes. Now, I don't know about you, but I'm a numbers guy. It really helps me to grasp things if I know when something occurred or how old were the participants, that sort of thing. So what I'm about to say comes from a class given by my godbrother Nagaraj Prabhu in New Ramanreti in Alachua, Florida. So Nagaraj, in my opinion, is one of the most gifted speakers when it comes to explaining our philosophy. He's also been the editor-in-chief of Back to Godhead magazine since 1998, 20 years, when he took over from Jayadvaita Swami. So in any event, Nagaraj Prabhu did some calculations in order to put Krishna's pastimes with the Pandavas into a kind of chronological perspective. So as we know, Arjun and Krishna were first cousins. Arjun's mother was Kunti, and Kunti's half-brother was Vasudev, Krishna's father. So Kunti and Vasudev's father was named Surasen. Krishna was born on, as we all know, Janmashtami, and Arjun was born 6.5 months later on the Palguni Purnim, which also happens to be the appearance day of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So Krishna was born on Janmashtami, and Arjun was born on Gaur Purnim. In the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, it's described that Krishna's friends, Sakyas, who are about the same age, are called Vayasyas. That means contemporaries. So both Arjun and the cowherd boys fit into that category. However, Krishna's village friends are of one category, and his city friends, such as Arjun, are of a different category, and they are called Pura Sambandhas, which means city friends or like city boys. When Pandu, the father of the Pandavas, of course, died, Arjun was about 14 years old, and then the Pandavas moved to Hastinapur. They were living in a rural area. They were practically like brahmanas, very austerely. So for 15 years, from ages 14 to 29, Arjuna and his brothers, of course, were trained in the military arts by Dronacharya, and when Arjun was 29, Yudhisthira was made the crown prince. This happened to be just about the time that Krishna moved to Dwarka, because Krishna was in Mathura from ages 11 to 29 or 30, at which point he built the Dwarka fort and relocated there. So Krishna was in Mathura about the same time that the Pandavas were in Hastinapur being trained by Dronacharya. About 5 years after Yudhisthira was made crown prince, the Pandavas and Mother Kunti were, quote, invited by Duryodhan and company to spend time away from Hastinapur in a hut specially built for them in the forest of Varnavrat. And as we all know, of course, that house was meant to be a death trap. So the burning of the house of Lakh happened about 5 years after Yudhisthira was made the crown prince, when Arjuna was about 34 years old. As we know, thankfully, the plot to kill them was foiled, but they remained in hiding for 4 years, so Duryodhan and company would think that they had succeeded in killing the Pandavas. During the time that the Pandavas were in hiding, they went to Draupadi's Swayamvar ceremony, the contest to qualify to marry her. They went dressed as brahmanas, and, of course, Arjun won Draupadi's hand. Nobody knew they were alive except Krishna. So he went to see them and first encountered Arjun in a potter's shed in Drupad Nagar, the place of Draupadi's ceremony. Krishna arrived and he introduced them, himself, to the Pandavas. Apparently, this is their first meeting. Now, we've all heard of the mood of separation from Krishna. But in this instance, we learn of another kind of separation. Separation is divided into two categories. One is after you've developed your relationship with Krishna, and then you lose his association and are eager to have his association again. But the other mode of separation occurs before you've ever met Krishna. You hear about Krishna and develop such a strong attraction that you long to be with him. Princess Rukmini is a perfect example of that. And in a sense, at a sadhana level, we're practicing hearing about Krishna so we gain attraction for Krishna. So it's described in the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu that as a younger man, Arjuna's mind was totally fixed in the military arts. But as soon as he began to hear about the sweet transcendental qualities of Krishna, his mind immediately became very anxious to meet him. So when he finally beheld Krishna's beautiful transcendental form in the potter's shed in Drupad Nagar, Arjuna was overjoyed since Krishna appeared as beautiful as a painted picture. It was then that Arjuna established a friendship with Krishna when they were both about 37 years old. So, after their four-year so-called hiding period after the burning of the house of Lakh, the Pandavas returned to Hastinapur and then built the so-called alternate capital at Indraprastha. Yudhisthira was crowned when Arjuna was 44 years old, and based on calculations made by another devotee that Nagaraj Prabhu cited, Yudhisthira was on the throne for something like 76 years. Between the ages of 44 and 56, Arjuna went into exile for 12 years. The Pandavas had an arrangement that because all five of them were married to one woman, Draupadi, the others would never interrupt when she was with one of her husbands. But one night, Arjuna had to protect someone, so he had to get his weapons, which are in the room where Draupadi was with one of her husbands. So even though Arjuna knew that he would have to go into exile for interrupting them, out of his Kshatriya duty, he did so anyway. Of course, the brothers wanted to exempt him from this exile, but he insisted. So during his 12 years in exile, he did many amazing things, including spending time with his father. Everyone knows who's the father of Arjuna is, Lord Indra, in the heavenly planets. And when he returned from exile at age 56, Arjuna married Krishna's sister, Subhadra, who would have been just about the same age. But it seems that before the time that Krishna Arjuna went into exile, the Kurukshetra eclipse and the meeting of Krishna with the residents of Vrindavan at Kurukshetra took place. Krishna would have been in his mid-40s, and I don't know if there's a Shastric reference, but we can probably assume that since Krishna never looked older than 16, his cowherd girlfriends were most likely endowed with the same quality of Navayovana, because it's hard to picture Krishna looking 16 and meeting with his formal girlfriends when they looked middle-aged. So Yudhisthira ruled from the alternate capital at Indraprastha for 16 years. And this was from the time Arjuna was 58 until he was 74. And of course, Krishna would visit them there. And then the Rajasuya sacrifice took place. But of course, before that, they had to kill Jarasandha. So by this time, Krishna and Arjuna would have been in their mid-70s. And within months after the Rajasuya sacrifice, the infamous gambling match took place, at which point the Pandavas lost everything and went into exile for 13 years. So they came out of exile when Arjuna was 87 years old. At this time, of course, Abhimanyu married Uttara. And about 2 years later, when Krishna and Arjuna were 89 years old, the Kurukshetra War took place. And then, sadly, 36 years later, Krishna closed out his earthly pastimes. So anyway, that's our brief numbers-based history lesson for today. The specific wording of today's verses says that the intelligent who have understood the Lord can never avoid hearing the Lord's glories, even though they have heard them only once. So I was a little puzzled by the word avoid, because it can have a negative connotation, like I'm trying to avoid eating too many sweets. But avoid means to stop oneself from doing. So taken literally, the verse means that the intelligent can't stop themselves from hearing the Lord's glories, even though they've heard them only once. And Srila Prabhupada then turns that concept up full volume in his purport when he states that once attraction for hearing about the transcendental activities of the Lord becomes prominent, it will go on progressively without stoppage like fire in gunpowder. So in material consciousness, we have no experience of something pleasurable increasing exponentially because our material senses burn out very quickly. But in spiritual consciousness, when our senses become purified and spiritualized, there's practically an infinite capacity for enjoyment. And since the source of all pleasure, Krishna, is in fact unlimited and ever-expanding, when we enter into a pure service mood, Krishna is happy to share that infinite enjoyment with us. Just like a rich man loves sharing his wealth with his family and friends because that increases his pleasure. The perverted reflection of that in the material world, doing something one cannot avoid, is compulsive or addictive behavior, activities that harm us even though we want to stop. But the original version of that is the laulyam, the greed to serve the Lord and his devotees and always hear and chant about Krishna's transcendental activities. So the final point I want to address is Krishna's transcendental ingenuity in overseeing the seamless functioning of this material world. First of all, let's talk about the so-called cloud, the ever-growing banks of data that increasingly record and govern our lives. I sometimes wonder if they'll ever run out of the space and energy and equipment needed to store all this data. Every email, every bank transaction, every purchase, every photo or video. But just like the ever-increasing banks of data in the so-called cloud, the unlimited karmic historic record of an infinite number of conditioned souls goes on increasing more and more. Our every thought, word, and deed throughout eternity is somehow kept on permanent file. And it's even stored after the cosmic annihilation because when we awaken to a new creation, we're reminded of our specific past material desires. But handling all this data is not a challenge for Krishna because he and his energies are infinite and ever increasing. Or as he says in the 10th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, with a single fragment of myself, I pervade and support this entire universe. Karma is incredibly complex. We'll never be able to figure out how we arrive where we are today in terms of our particular mind, body, happiness, and distress. Nor should we even try. What I find most intriguing is the karmic relationships between conditioned souls, family members, for example. The parenting we received was either good, bad, or mixed. And as every parent knows, certain children are more troublesome to raise and others less so. So the attitude and behavior of the parents becomes the karma of the child. And the child's particular nature becomes the karma of the parents. So how did Krishna match us up so that, in my case, I received exactly the parents I deserved and my parents received the child that was me and that they deserved? A wife ends up marrying a husband because karmically she deserved him and karmically he deserved her. And then they produce children that they deserved karmically and the children that they produce deserve them karmically. And when you expand it into the greater family and then the entire society, it becomes particularly bewildering. One's teachers, employers, government leaders, and if one is lucky, one's spiritual master, how can Krishna fit all these innumerable parts together, all the while feeding everyone, reforming everyone, and fulfilling everyone's desire according to their past deeds, and also encouraging everyone towards the spiritual path so we can escape the internal enmeshment that is the material world? And that's the point that Srila Prabhupada addresses so strongly in today's purport. Now, I'm quoting, home, country, family, society, wealth, and all sorts of corollaries are all causes of bondage in the material world. Material society, friendship, and love are all different phases of lust. There's no end to such sense gratificatory business, and the conditioned soul becomes entangled in such servitude without hope of release. The release is only effected by association with pure devotees. By such association, one is gradually promoted to his transcendental consciousness. Thus he can know that his eternal position is to render service unto the Lord and not to the perverted senses in the capacity of lust, anger, and the desire to lord it over. End quote. So we live in an invisible, seamless prison that is so subtle that in the conditioned state, we're convinced that, number one, I'm God, and thus I'm in charge. And number two, I'm completely free. It's only through the wisdom, the vision, the compassion and grace of the pure devotee that we come to understand both the nature of the prison and the characteristics of true freedom. And that's a debt we will never be able to repay. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Thank you very much. I don't really feel qualified to answer questions. All I know is right here. But if there are some comments or corrections, Maharaj. Yes. Is there a microphone?
So people who are twins, do they have some relation in a past life? Because it just seems so, you know.
So the question is, when twins are born, do they have some relation? Well, I mean, as I said, karma is impossible to figure out, but it's very likely. I once spoke to Amarendra Prabhu, and I said, do you think that families sort of stay together for a certain number of births? And he said, birds of a feather flock together. So there's some likelihood that twins share a lot of karma, which may have come from past lives. Yes, Archie Taji.
Hi, Haribol Prabhu. Thank you for your wonderful numbers presentation. You really are a numbers guy. And thank you also for accepting the invitation to speak. And we hope that you continue to fit in the schedule.
Thank you.
One comment was that, especially for the newer people, it may seem strange that, you know, Arjuna is begetting children at 50-something. But we should remember, this is like the tail end of Dwapara Yuga. And in that yuga, people are living to 100,000 years. I mean, sorry, 1,000 years. That's the norm, you could say, for that yuga. In this age, the norm is, say, 100. So to beget children at 56 when you're expected to live 1,000 years, it's not a big deal. You know, it's here, if we start doing it at 50, that's half of our lifetime gone. But in that yuga, 500 years would be half the life. So to do all these activities at 50, 70, 80, 125, as we know when Krishna left this planet, you know, it's like youth. They're still young.
On the painting of Arjuna on the chariot, he looks like he's in the bloom of youth, but he was 89 years old. But it's not 89 of our years. Plus, they're transcendental personalities, so it doesn't fit our model. All right. Thank you very much for your attention. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Haribol.